Parshas Mishpatim, as well, hello. This Parshas Mishpatim, we know, comes after the Aseres HaDibros. And Mishpatim, as the name indicates, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's God-given rules of conduct, both between, we call Bein Adam L'Chaveroi, between one individual and another, and also the life within the community. It says in the Medrash says, he says, I'm going to tell you right off, many of the halachas in this parsha are technically involved and are beyond the scope of his work and probably of any short type of analysis, because there's full gemaras that cover this, right? And he says, there are mitzvos here that the Torah talks about again elsewhere, giving us more information, such as the right not to oppress a ger, when to lend money, or the necessity to lend money to those in need, when to help upload someone else's animal that's falling under its load. The rule of Shemitah, we have again here, as we have in Emor, as we have in Bamidbor, as we have in Devarim, certain laws of Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkos. We have mention of the Bikurim in the Beis HaMikdash, and an admonishment to the Jewish people that they were not to enter into any peace treaties with the seven nations who were there. The seven nations were considered so corrupt by HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he did not want them any longer to live in Eretz Yisrael, where they could influence the Jewish people. He notes that the progression of mitzvos, as they were given to the Jewish people, began at Morah, right? They were given the Torah on Har Sinai, and then they were given additional mishpatim, right? While they were still at the foot of Har Sinai, we know that they stayed in the vicinity of Sinai for about a year, and they continued to get aspects of Torah there. He says the Aseres HaDibros were in some ways preceded and then followed by Mishpatim, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted the Jewish nation to have the recognition that Mishpatim are the lifeblood of Yahadus, of Judaism. Without a structured set of halachos, you do not have a structured religion that can continue. Hashem, in his wisdom, gave the other nations seven laws, and they haven't done a very good job historically in keeping them. Right? Klal Yisrael, if you look, for example, at the Mishnah Berurah, if you look at the Rambam, if you look at the Yoredeya, we would say that there's thousands of mitzvos or subsets of mitzvos. We know that we have Svarim that tell us what the 613 mitzvos are, But we know also that many of them are subdivided into such intricate details that if you were to keep each detail as a separate mitzvah, you would end up with an exceedingly high number of mitzvahs. And Chachamim continue to tell us, and he quotes from Pirkei Avos, that Mishpatim equals survival of the human civilization, led by the nation which has taken HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mission. And Pirkei Avos says, the world is maintained, emes, mishpat, shalom, truth, justice, and peace. The question that was often asked, and probably by many of those who tossed away aspects of Judaism, who needs a religion with such an intricate, detailed, copious set of rules? And we get an analogy that a doctor was in the hospital doing his rounds of a patient, and he bends over one patient and he says, this patient's diet need no longer be restricted. Let him eat whatever his heart desires. He goes to the guy in the next bed sharing the room, and he gives him a long list of restricted foods, beverages, etc. And his intern is a little bit surprised, and as interns are learning, he asks the doctor, why the difference in the diet requirements? He said, the patient whom you gave carte blanche to, in my mind, is much more ill than the patient you gave a very, very limited diet to. Why? And he said, you've got to understand, the first man is a hopeless case. He's not going to live very long. So let him have whatever he wants. Let him enjoy as much as he can. The second person has the ability to live a much longer and productive life. To do so, because of whatever medical deficiencies he has, he needs this restricted diet. Klal Yisrael, right, became the nation able to attain the highest levels of Kedusha, the highest levels of holiness in this world. Having the ability to live long, productive lives and to give a legacy on to next generations. They required, kaviyachol, the limited diet. They needed to be limited in what they would do in this world, what activities, what foods, etc., they would eat and experience. The goyim, on the other hand, after they rejected the Torah, were like that patient who doesn't have a long way to go. There's no ability for any Goyish nation to sustain itself over time. Every great secular nation who once was no longer is, because they don't abide by the what we would call the rules of longevity, which is the Torah. Therefore, Moshe was given the task to make the Mishpatim a Shulchan Aruch. It was to be a set table where you come to the table and can eat, where you can understand the halacha, where you're not confused. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Klal Yisroel the responsibility to go to a Beis Din. Because the Beis Din, as it was set up, especially in Moshe Rabbeinu's time, was the fairest, most objective way of settling any differences. And we know that the halacha is that a yid is actually forbidden to go to a goyish court first if he has a dispute with another yid. The traditional view of going to court was it's a denial of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's divinity, because what you're saying, in effect, is the Torah can't handle this. I think for those of us who hear this, we could probably say we can understand that the Beis Dinim in Moshe's days, probably maybe in Ezra's days, etc., were not corruptible. Unfortunately, in today's day and age, we hear too many horror stories about so-called Beis Din, and that is a problem in Golis. The first halacha that Mishpatim deals with is that of the Eved Ivri. A person becomes a Hebrew slave. And we're told this happens for two reasons. One, somebody stole something, was caught, could not make restitution, and so the court would sell him for an amount of money which was used to pay restitution to the victim. The other thing that could happen is that unfortunately someone is in extreme poverty, cannot provide for themselves, and so basically sells themselves to someone Jewish to be their slave. We know from the Gemaras, from the Mefarshim, etc., that there's a problem in being a slave, because it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu said at Har Sinai, "You are my servants and not servants of servants," meaning that if you have a human master over you, there is, right, a lack of direct relationship with the Rabbona Shel Olam. The other thing we're told is that if the person had been a thief, the person failed to listen to the mitzvahs at Sinai, which said that this was inappropriate. So that, too, was a lowering of the religious status of the individual. We're told that they could not have public auctions to sell slaves. Rather, there was had to be some type of dignified manner in doing it. I don't know if Basedon basically had a buy a slave website or something like that in those days, and right, and it was done discreetly, etc. The Torah refers to the individual as an Hebrew slave, but we're told that whoever actually acquired a Hebrew slave was in fact acquiring a master, because the halachos and how you must treat a Jewish slave are very onerous. The Hebrew slave had to live in a basically excellent condition, right? It is forbidden to give the slave lowly, disgusting tasks, such as you must wash the master's feet, you must bend down and put shoes on the master. The slave must be fed with the same standard of delicacy that the master has. You cannot buy cheaper food for the slave, but whatever the master put on his table, that was the level which he was required to feed the slave. And it says that if the situation occurred where there was only one proper portion of food or one proper portion of wine available at a time, the slave got it, not the master. If the slave, who would want to do it? Probably only someone who was a tzaddik, who was prepared to do it and had the financial ability to do it. Because it almost seems that what you were buying was a permanent guest in your home. Right? However, there is a trade-off. We'll come to that in a minute. And we also know that if the master acquired a slave with a particular ability, for example, the guy was an excellent carpenter, that was the type of work he would have him do. Now, whether he could lease him out to someone else, basically act as a subcontractor so the slave could do carpentry, maybe that was possible. But he couldn't tell the carpenter, I want you to clean out the chicken coop. I mean, it was really a tremendous responsibility. The one thing he could do, as long as the slave was married to a Jewish woman, he could give the slave a shifcha kenainis. He could take a shiksa that he owned, slave, and have the slave live with the shiksa, have children, which would basically be slaves in perpetuity to the master. So the one thing that the slave could only do, as I say, as a slave, was to produce other slaves, and a free Jewish person could never do that. So there was a real, I would say, a tangible denigration of the individual who was a slave because of this. We know that a Jewish slave was only allowed to be sold for a period of up to 6 years. And after 6 years, he would be sent out. And when he was sent out, you had to give him severance presents. You had to let him be, you had to give him what he would need to begin to be independent once again. And it says, even if the slave had become ill while being owned by the master, and the master had to pay significantly for medications, for rehabilitation, the slave had no responsibility to compensate the master. The other thing that was, right, completely shocking is that if he bought a slave and the slave had a family, the master now had the additional responsibility to support the family while the slave was in his employ. If the gentleman who's a slave was single, he wasn't allowed to pair him up with a shiksa to have babies. But only for a fellow who was already married. In other words, the slave had a wife, right? And he became a slave. The master now took the responsibility to support the wife. And only because he had a proper Jewish wife was he allowed to propagate and create slaves for the master. But if the individual was single, you weren't allowed to do that. And I imagine the reason was, is, you know, if he was single, he may decide, I really like this wife and I'm going nowhere, which becomes problematic because we know that there's a means that after 6 years, if the Eved says, I don't want to leave, I really like it here, I love the woman I'm with, I like these little slaves that call me daddy, my master is such a great guy, I love being in his employ, he can stay longer, right, up to Yovel, up to the year, the Jubilee year. Now, I've never learned what happens if the slave says, I'm going to stay, and the master says, no way, Jose, you're leaving. I don't know who holds the option. I mean, you would like to think that if a master says, Dayenu, I don't need this anymore, after I've fulfilled the term, that he can't be forced. But I don't, you know, I haven't learned the... Go ahead. Go ahead. Right. If a slave becomes, as you say, you know, too comfortable in his slave environment and wants to stay there in perpetuity, does the master not have any ability not to do it? And surprisingly, I guess I've never looked into it, and maybe I may ask the rabbi if I see him later, what happens in the... They remain slaves. The children remain slaves. Their children remain slaves. The Jewish religion allowed someone to own, we call them Canaanite slaves. You could own them. And you were required to own them forever. You really weren't supposed to emancipate them. Those slaves, right, for those to remain slaves, they had to have, if they were males, they had to have a bris, and they had to accept mitzvahs, and they were considered a quasi-Jew, and if they ever went free, they automatically became a full Jew. But that's the halach. In other words, a potential goyish slave, from what I learned, had the ability to say yay or nay, I'm not accepting Judaism. And if he wasn't accepting Judaism, you would sell him to a goy. He could not remain under a Jewish household if he did not accept the status of partial Jewishness. And they were required to keep the same mitzvot that a woman does. In other words, they're exempt from the time-bound mitzvot, but not others. Right? So, I mean, all this stuff is complicated. And like that, as we said at the beginning, you've got to go through all the Gemaras, and that even with the Gemaras, you probably have to go through the Rambam with Mefarshim to understand what the bottom line is in a lot of these cases. So, you know, that's why at the end of the day, they always said, if somebody acquired a Jewish slave, he really bought himself a major master. Okay, we'll stop here. I think tomorrow what I want to do is pick up the backside of Mishpatim, which talks about the other things that occurred at Matan.